Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 99.
The opening scene of our source material seems, well, if you just glance at it, entirely lighthearted.
It really does. It looks like a comedy scene.
Yeah. We are in the inner chambers with the family matriarchs, Grandmother Jia and Aunt Sue. And holding court is Wang Shifeng.
Also known as Fengji.
Right, Fengji. Now, she is this incredibly sharp-tongued, ruthlessly capable manager of this sprawling household. She oversees the finances, the servants, everything.
The daily logistics of hundreds of people. She is basically the CEO of the inner quarters.
And right now, she is putting on what is essentially a stand-up comedy routine for the older women.
She is doing crowd work. She's laughing before she even delivers the punchline.
She really is. She sets the stage by announcing she has a hilarious story about the newlyweds in the house.
That would be Bao Yu, the male heir of the family, and his new wife, Bao Shai.
So Shifeng launches into this incredibly elaborate physical comedy bit. She mimics peeking through the window into their private quarters.
Her acting is very physical here.
Very. She twists her body, showing one person sitting rigidly and the other slumping. She describes Bao Yu, who has recently survived a near-fatal illness.
He's incredibly weak.
He's practically begging his new wife for a sliver of attention. He's saying, "Sister Bao, why won't you talk to me? If you just say one word, my sickness will be completely cured."
And Bao Chai's response to her husband's desperate pleading is just ice.
Yeah, she simply turns her head away. She entirely avoids his gaze. She physically walls him off.
Which naturally prompts Bao Yu to try and force the interaction.
Right. And he is physically devastated from his illness. He's barely able to stand. He tries to bow to her, reaches out to grab her silken clothes. And because his legs are practically jelly, he loses his balance.
He literally collapses onto her lap.
He does. Now, in a normal loving relationship, or even just a basic compassionate human interaction, your immediate reaction would be concern.
Of course.
Sure.
Are you hurt? Let me help you up.
Exactly. But Bao Chai blushes furiously, shoves him off, and scolds him. She snaps, "You are even less respectful than before."
And when Shifeng acts out this rigid, awkward, entirely affectionless encounter for the matriarchs, the room just erupts in laughter.
And Xue, who is Bao Chai's mother, actually waves it off. She chuckles and says, "Oh, that's just Bao Chai being eccentric. They're a married couple now. What's wrong with a little joking around?"
It's pure denial.
Okay, let's unpack this, because looking at the mechanics of what Shifeng is describing, the humor feels incredibly grotesque.
It's deeply unsettling.
It's like watching a dark psychological thriller where a laugh track has been inexplicably layered over a scene of profound emotional abuse.
That dissonance is entirely intentional on the author's part. Shifeng is highly attuned to the psychological weather of the household.
She knows exactly what she's doing.
Oh, she does. The matriarchs aren't laughing because a sick boy falling over is inherently funny. They're laughing because the atmosphere in the Jia household is currently suffocating under the weight of a massive unacknowledged trauma.
They are mourning the death of Lin Daiyu.
Precisely.
And for context, Daiyu was Baiyu's absolute soulmate. They grew up together in the garden. They communicated through poetry, through shared tears.
They had a profound, almost spiritual understanding of one another.
But the family, prioritizing social stability and alliances over romantic love, orchestrated this massive deception. They essentially tricked Baiyu into marrying Bao Chai.
While Daiyu was literally dying of illness and a broken heart just a few courtyards away, it's tragic.
It really is. So Baiyu's current illness isn't just a random flu. It is the physical manifestation of a shattered psyche.
He's a traumatized, hollowed-out shell of a human being, begging for a scrap of connection.
And Bao Chai is equally trapped in this nightmare. We can't forget that. She was raised to be the perfect, orthodox Confucian wife.
She isn't a villain in the mustache-twirling sense, right? She is a woman operating flawlessly within the parameters of a system that values propriety over passion.
She's forced to play the role of the dignified, stoic manager to a husband who is fundamentally broken.
When he collapses on her, her instinct isn't empathy. It's to police his compliance with the rules of decorum.
Because her job isn't to love him. Her job is to regulate him.
That's a great way to put it. The text actually gives us a highly specific, deeply philosophical phrase to describe Bao Yu's internal state post-trauma.
Oh, yeah. The text notes that his memory is intact. He can sit at a desk, recognize the books in front of him, and recite the words.
But he has lost his lingji.
Lingji, what does that actually mean in this context?
It translates roughly to spiritual spark or vital intelligence. In the metaphysics of the novel, this spark is tied to a magical jade amulet Bao Yu was born with, which he has recently lost.
But practically, on a psychological level, what does it look like?
Psychologically, it represents his vitality, his capacity for deep emotion, his very soul. Without it, he is docile.
He no longer throws tantrums or rails against the suffocating rules of his family.
He is compliant, but he's entirely empty.
Shirin, who is his primary maid and essentially his caretaker, explicitly observes this horrifying transformation.
She is the one who really sees the cost of this piece.
Yeah, she looks at him and asks, "Why have you forgotten your former spark?" She notes this terrifying paradox. It's technically a relief that he isn't causing trouble anymore, but his underlying temperament is just gone.
He operates in this muddled, foggy state.
And when she questions him about this, Bao Yu doesn't offer a philosophical defense. He doesn't cry. He just giggles.
He just offers this vacant, agreeable smile.
He has been successfully pacified by the system, but the cost was his humanity.
And Bao Chai understands this completely. She is highly intelligent. She knows her husband's soul is gone, but she makes no attempt to heal it.
Because healing it might bring back the chaotic, passionate poet who loved Dai Yu.
Exactly. Instead, she manages the hollow shell that remains. Whenever his behavior threatens to cross the line of social acceptability, she uses her position to restrain him.
Their marriage is basically a microcosm of the imperial system itself.
Prioritize outward stability, suppress individual disruption, and maintain the illusion of order at any psychological cost.
Wow. And this hollowing out of the individual is perfectly mirrored by the physical hollowing out of their environment. And it reads like an architectural obituary.
The garden used to be this vibrant, insulated utopia. It was specifically designed to protect the youth from the corrupting influence of the adult, bureaucratic world outside.
It was filled with laughter, poetry competitions, innocent romance.
But now the text meticulously lists the departures, tolling them like a bell.
It's so sad. Baokin has moved back to Aunt Xu's residence. Shan Yun was summoned away for her arranged marriage.
Xian left with Lady Zheng after Ying Chun was married off. And Ying Chun's marriage, by the way, is to a brutal man who mistreats her.
Right. The Li sisters have moved out. This bustling, interconnected community of brilliant young women has been dismantled by the machinery of arranged marriages and patriarchal duty.
Only a sparse few remain. Li Wan, Tan Chun, and Xi Chun. Living this sprawling, silent complex.
I want you as a listener to just imagine returning to your childhood home years after everyone has moved out, or walking through your university campus in the dead of winter break long after you've graduated.
The physical structures are all perfectly intact, the courtyards, the pavilions.
But the energy that animated the space, the shared history that made it a living entity, has completely evaporated. The buildings feel oppressive.
Almost accusatory in their emptiness.
Grandmother Jia is acutely aware of this haunting psychological weight. She actually issues a strict directive forbidding Bao Yu from freely roaming the garden.
Her reasoning is explicitly tied to the architecture of grief.
She knows that Dai Yu's former residence, the Zhaoxang Pavilion, sits empty. The text uses a really poignant phrase here.
The person is gone, but the house remains.
Grandmother Jia operates under the assumption that if Bao Yu sees the physical space where his love lived and died, the visual trigger will shatter his fragile state.
It would plunge him back into madness.
So the solution is avoidance. Lock the gates. Ignore the empty pavilions. They treat the physical landscape of the garden the exact same way Bao Chai treats Bao Yu's emotional landscape.
Enforce boundaries, eliminate triggers, and maintain the surface calm.
The poetry is dead. The era of youth is over. They are now in the business of surviving the emptiness.
And this domestic tragedy, this realization that survival requires the suppression of one's fundamental nature, isn't isolated to the teenagers in the garden.
Not at all. It is the exact same brutal lesson that Bao Yu's father, Jia Zhang, is about to learn on a massive political scale.
The narrative seamlessly shifts from the intimate rod of a marriage to the institutional rod of an empire.
So let's follow Jia Zhang out of the capital. He has been appointed to a highly lucrative, immensely powerful provincial post as a grain intendant.
To understand the stakes here, we really have to look at the logistics of the Qing dynasty economy.
Yeah, the grain intendant wasn't just managing a few silos of wheat, right?
Oh, no. He was responsible for overseeing the collection of the grain tax from millions of peasants. He managed the massive imperial granaries.
And ensured the smooth transport of that grain via the Grand Canal to feed the capital and the military. It was a position with massive economic leverage.
Crucially, however, Jia Zhang is uniquely unqualified for the gritty reality of this role.
Completely unqualified. Up until this appointment, he has been a creature of the central ministries.
He is a classic Confucian scholar official. He has spent his life studying ancient texts on virtue, writing elegant reports.
Debating moral philosophy in immaculate halls, he has zero practical experience with the boots-on-the-ground, friction-heavy reality of local administration.
He understands the theoretical concept of a peasant, but he doesn't understand the socio-economic machinery required to actually extract taxes from one.
So he rolls into his new provincial headquarters, operating purely on textbook idealism.
He immediately summons his advisors and local magistrates and unleashes a series of sweeping, draconian edicts.
He absolutely bans the acceptance of any gifts, no matter how small. He bans all forms of bribery.
And most importantly, he bans the deeply entrenched practice of local clerks extorting extra grain or copper from the peasants during the tax collection process.
He draws a hard line in the sand, declaring a regime of absolute moral purity, zero tolerance for corruption, with immediate termination for anyone caught violating the rules.
Now, on paper, in a philosophical treatise, this is exactly how a virtuous minister is supposed to act.
Protect the people, uphold the emperor.
Exactly.
But let's map this onto a modern equivalent to see why it instantly detonates. Imagine a highly educated, deeply principled academic is unexpectedly named the CEO of a sprawling legacy manufacturing conglomerate.
Okay, I can picture this.
This new CEO looks at the company ledgers, discovers the sales division is padding their expense accounts, using corporate funds for lavish client dinners, taking kickbacks. Appalled, the CEO instantly implements a zero-tolerance policy.
No more expense accounts.
None. Every single transaction must be transparent and strictly by the book. What the CEO fails to understand is that the base salaries of the sales team are fundamentally unlivable.
And the only way the company actually secures contracts in this specific industry is through those lavish dinners and gray market negotiations.
By enforcing the rules, the CEO doesn't purify the company. He instantly paralyzes the entire revenue stream.
What's fascinating here is that that is precisely the catastrophe Jia Zhang triggers. And the reaction of his immediate staff reveals the hidden economic engine of the imperial bureaucracy.
It sparks an immediate, desperate revolt among his own servants. And we aren't talking about maids and cooks here.
No, we are talking about his administrative retinue. The gatekeepers, the private secretaries, the fixers who followed him from the capital.
They didn't travel hundreds of miles out of blind loyalty. They attached themselves to his political ascension as a financial investment.
This requires a dive into the bizarre salary structure of historical bureaucracies. In the Qing dynasty, the official state-issued salary for a magistrate or an intendant was incredibly, almost comically small.
It was called something ironic, right?
Nourishing honesty, silver, or yangli and yin. But it was rarely enough to cover the massive overhead required to run a local government.
Right, because an official had to hire his own private secretaries, feed dozens of retainers, maintain this level of aristocratic display.
And constantly send expensive gifts back to superiors in the capital to maintain his political standing.
So if the official salary doesn't even cover the electric bill, so to speak, how does the system survive?
Through the margins. Through what were euphemistically called customary fees or lewdy.
These were essentially institutionalized bribes and surcharges. When a peasant paid their grain tax, the clerk would charge an extra percentage to cover wastage or meltage.
And that extra percentage would flow upward, enriching the clerks, the local magistrate, the intendant's servants, and the intendant himself.
Jia Zhang's servants knew exactly how this system worked. The text reveals a startling financial reality here.
These servants explicitly borrowed massive amounts of money back in the capital just to afford the silk robes and the transportation required to accompany Jia Zhang.
They patronized pawn shops and took out high-interest loans, calculating that once their master took control of the provincial granaries, they would act as the gatekeepers.
Anyone wanting a favor, a government contract, or leniency would have to bribe them to get access to Jia Zhang. They projected a massive return on their investment.
And suddenly, Jia Zhang shuts down the entire underground economy. The servants are watching a fortune slip through their fingers because their boss is having an acute attack of moral superiority.
They panic. They're sitting in their quarters, literally calculating their runway.
One servant notes that they can't even hold out for another 2 weeks before their creditors back in the capital start foreclosing on their families.
They complain bitterly, like, we spent all this money to buy our way into this retinue. We've been sitting here for a month, and we haven't seen a single copper coin.
Their financial model is entirely broken. The system they bought into has been unilaterally dismantled. So they formulate a collective bargaining strategy.
They plan to stage a mass walkout. They approach Jia Zhang the next morning to request a leave of absence to return to the capital.
Essentially threatening to leave him completely isolated and unstaffed in a strange province.
And how does the brilliant, morally upright Jia Zhang handle a massive labor dispute threatening to cripple his administration?
He completely ignores the root cause. He doesn't pull his head servants aside and ask, why are you all suddenly desperate to leave?
He doesn't investigate the financial pressures at all.
He just waves his hand with this arrogant detachment and says, if you want to come, come. If you want to go, go. If you don't like it here, do as you please.
He believes he is projecting stoic, Confucian unbotheredness. In reality, he is demonstrating a catastrophic ignorance of the ecosystem he commands.
He thinks government runs on the sheer willpower of imperial edicts. He has no idea it actually runs on leverage, kickbacks, and the management of dependent livelihoods.
By attempting to be a paragon of virtue without understanding the socioeconomic foundation of his own household, he is actively destroying the lives of the people who depend on him. He creates a massive power vacuum.
And nature and bureaucracies abhor a vacuum.
Always.
Enter the true breakout character, a gatekeeper named Li Shire.
While the other servants are packing their bags and lamenting their debts, Li Shire looks at the walkout and sees the opportunity of a lifetime.
He doesn't stay out of loyalty, does he?
No, he stays because a completely isolated, clueless official is the perfect puppet for a hostile takeover.
Li Shire is a masterful psychological operator. The text outlines his strategy in two distinct, brilliant phases. First, he has to establish absolute dominance over the local provincial bureaucrats.
He can't run a shadow government if the local magistrates don't respect him.
There is a phenomenal scene that illustrates this. A local clerk named Zan Hui comes creeping around the intendant's compound, desperate for information.
Zan Hui represents the local magistrates, the guys actually down in the dirt collecting the grain.
Li Shire receives him, but he doesn't just chat. He asserts physical and conversational dominance.
Li Shire sits back, crosses one leg over the other, keeps his posture rigid, and essentially forces Zan Hui to beg for scraps of insight.
Zan Hui spills a crucial piece of intelligence. He admits that Jia Zhang's anti-corruption edicts have terrified the local magistrates to the point of total paralysis.
The magistrates haven't even opened the granaries to begin the autumn tax collection.
Why? Because without the ability to charge those customary fees and skim off the top, the magistrates literally cannot afford to pay the transport workers to move the grain.
Jia Zhang's morality hasn't purified the supply chain. It has completely frozen the imperial economy in that province.
Li Shire realizes he holds all the cards. He immediately bluffs, taking credit for the administrative chaos.
He implies to Zan Hui that he is the one advising Jia Zhang to hold back the official orders, creating this illusion that he is the true power behind the throne.
He violently intimidates Zan Hui, threatening to have him beaten and stripped of his position if he attempts to bypass Li Shire.
And then, in a textbook sociopathic pivot, the second Zan Hui is thoroughly cowed and trembling, Li Shire softens his voice, offers a warm smile, and says, oh, I've heard so much about your competence. Let's get together for drinks tonight and sort this all out.
It is a stunning display of manipulation. He breaks the man down and instantly rebuilds him as a loyal subordinate in his new shadow network.
Having secured the obedience of the local grifters, Li Shire now has to execute phase two, breaking the moral resolve of his boss, Jia Zhang.
So what does this all mean? How does a servant, someone structurally at the absolute bottom of the social hierarchy, convince a highly educated, wealthy, aristocratic patriarch to abandon his entire moral framework?
He weaponizes Jia Zhang's own isolation against him. Li Shire waits patiently. He lets Jia Zhang experience the crushing friction of trying to operate the government cleanly.
Jia Zhang quickly realizes that without the influx of customary fees, he doesn't have the operating budget to pay for basic administrative supplies, let alone his own kitchen expenses.
He is actually paying out of pocket just to feed his remaining staff. He is stressed, exhausted, and feeling the walls close in.
That is the exact moment Li Shire strikes.
The argument Li Shire presents is devastating because it contains zero philosophical rhetoric. It is pure, unfiltered pragmatism.
He walks into Jia Zhang's study and casually drops a political landmine. He mentions that the regional commander, the Jidushi, who is the highest ranking military and civil official in the area, and essentially Jia Zhang's direct superior, has a birthday coming up.
Li Shire casually notes that all the other provincial officials are preparing lavish gifts. We're talking thousands, tens of thousands of taels of silver. antique calligraphy, jade carvings, pure bullion.
And Lee Shire simply asks, Master, how much are we allocating for the commander's birthday tribute?
Jia Zhang is entirely blindsided. He hasn't received a single memo about this. He asks, bewildered, why hasn't anyone informed me of this protocol?
And Lee Shire gently, almost sympathetically, explains the reality of the situation. He tells Jia Zhang that because of his strict anti-corruption edicts, he has alienated the entire provincial network.
The local officials despise him. They aren't going to give him inside political intelligence. In fact, they actively want him to fail.
They want him to embarrass himself by snubbing the regional commander, hoping he gets impeached so one of them can take his lucrative post.
Jia Zhang's immediate reaction is defensive indignation. He wraps himself in his imperial mandate. He says, I was appointed directly by the Son of Heaven, the Emperor himself. Are you telling me that if I don't participate in this bribery ring and send a birthday gift, I can no longer serve as an official?
Lee Shire dismantles that naive idealism with surgical precision. He explains the brutal mechanics of the imperial reporting structure.
Master, he essentially argues, the Emperor is confined behind the walls of the Forbidden City, thousands of miles away. He only knows what is written in the reports sent by the provincial leaders.
And who writes the performance review on your administration, that exact regional commander whose birthday you are planning to ignore?
Lee Shire explains that if the commander feels slighted, he will simply write a memorial to the throne accusing Jia Zhang of incompetence or, ironically, corruption.
The emperor will believe the commander. Jia Zhang's career will be terminated.
Lee Shire maps out the inevitable collapse of Jia Zhang's moral crusade. If you remain strict, Lee Shire argues, you will be hated by your superiors for not feeding money up the chain.
You will be actively sabotaged by your underlings who are currently starving because you cut off their income.
And worst of all, the common people you are trying to protect will actually suffer more. Lee Shire explains that out of spite and to make up for lost revenue, the local magistrates will just extort the peasants twice as hard through hidden taxes.
And they will blame the brutality on the inflexible, tyrannical new intendant.
It is the ultimate systemic trap. Lee Shire lays it out bare. Your morality is a luxury that is actively destroying your career, bankrupting your family, and harming the peasants. You have to feed the machine or the machine will consume you.
He looks at Jia Zhang and delivers the final blow. You must look out for yourself, Master, while you still have the energy and the backing of your powerful family.
The moment of capitulation is one of the most chilling scenes in the text. You can vividly picture the physical deflation of Jia Zhang.
He is sitting in his study, surrounded by his books of Confucian ethics, realizing they are entirely useless in the face of this ruthless bureaucracy.
He realizes he is trapped, and he utters the sentence that officially damns him.
I just want to keep my life. Whatever you guys do, it has nothing to do with me.
It has nothing to do with me. That phrase is the foundational creed of plausible deniability. It is the exact moment an individual surrenders their agency to the system.
It's a psychological sleight at hand. Jia Zhang retreats deeper into his study. He gets to maintain his public persona as the uncorrupted scholar.
He never physically touches the silver. He never directly extorts a peasant. He can look in the mirror and convince himself he is still a good man.
Meanwhile, just outside his door, Lee Shire assumes total control. Lee Shire begins running a massive, highly efficient shadow corruption ring entirely in Jia Zhang's name.
He negotiates the bribes with the local magistrates, he skims the grain tax, and he ensures the regional commander receives a suitably massive birthday tribute.
And the most tragic part, the text explicitly notes that once Lee Shire takes over the graft, the government suddenly runs flawlessly.
The grain is collected on time. The transport barges move smoothly down the canal.
The local magistrates are happy because they are getting paid. The regional commander is happy because he got his tribute. And the emperor is happy because the grain quotas are met.
The system reaches a state of perfect homeostasis. Corruption in this environment is not a virus attacking the system. It is the operating code that allows the system to function.
Jia Zhang believes he has solved the puzzle. He believes he has successfully outsourced his moral compromise to Lee Shire, buying himself peace and stability.
He's back in his bubble, safe from the dirt.
But the profound lesson of the dream of the Red Chamber is that you cannot selectively participate in a corrupt system. The rot you ignore inevitably spreads.
Just when Jia Zhang thinks he is safe, the horrific reality of the world he has tolerated lands directly on his desk.
We find Jia Zhang several months later, sitting comfortably in his study. The immediate crisis of the local granaries is a distant memory, The machinery is humming quietly in the background.
He receives a letter from an old political ally, Zhu Qiong.
This letter is a perfect artifact of aristocratic normalcy. Zhu Qiong is writing in elegant, flowery prose, proposing a marriage between his son and Jia Zhang's daughter, Tan Xun.
It is the aristocracy engaging in its primary method of survival, utilizing their children as political capital to forge alliances between powerful families.
Jia Zhang reads it, strokes his beard, and feels a sense of patriarchal satisfaction. He is arranging the future. It's a moment of deep, undisturbed peace.
But the peace is obliterated instantly.
Right after setting down the marriage proposal, Jia Zhang picks up his daily reading material. He begins reviewing the Dibao.
Now, to modern ears, a government gazette in the 18th century might sound like a primitive bulletin board, but the Dibao was actually a highly sophisticated rapid transit intelligence network.
It was an internal publication distributed constantly throughout the empire via relay stations, detailing imperial decrees, military movements, and crucially, legal summaries from the central ministries in Beijing.
As Jia Zhang is scanning the legal reports from the Ministry of Justice, his eyes lock onto a case involving a name intimately connected to his own household. Xu Pan.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Xu Pan is a walking disaster. He is Bao Chai's older brother, the same Bao Chai we discussed enforcing emotional repression on Bao Yu in the first segment.
Xu Pan represents the grotesque extreme of aristocratic privilege. He's immensely wealthy, staggeringly arrogant, poorly educated, and notoriously prone to sudden extreme violence.
The Gazette details his latest atrocity.
The report outlines an incident at an inn in a provincial location called Taiping County. Xu Pan was traveling, stopped at the inn, and ordered wine to drink with a companion.
The waiter, a working-class man named Zhang San, brings the wine. Xu Pan tastes it, finds it lacking, and demands the waiter bring a better vintage.
The waiter, likely exhausted and dealing with an irate aristocrat, politely explains that the wine has already been poured and cannot be exchanged.
What happens next is a devastating escalation of entitlement. Xu Pan, fueled by alcohol and rage, completely loses his temper.
The original report filed by the local magistrate framed the ensuing violence as a tragic accident.
The initial story was that Xu Pan threw a bowl of wine in the waiter's general direction. The waiter tragically tripped or ducked to pick up some dropped chopsticks, and the bowl inadvertently struck him on the head, breaking the skin and leading to his death.
This is where we have to examine the precise anatomy of a bureaucratic cover-up. Because the Qing Dynasty legal code was highly complex and categorized homicides with extreme specificity.
The local magistrate, who had been heavily bribed by the Jia and Xu families to manage the fallout, classified the death under the law of accidental misstep.
Under this specific legal statute, unintentional manslaughter generally resulted in a financial penalty.
The perpetrator pays a fine to the state, pays burial compensation to the victim's family, and the case is closed.
It is the ultimate manifestation of wealthy privilege written directly into the legal code.
You violently end the life of a working class man, and the system processes it as a minor administrative fee, a line item on your travel expenses.
But the cover-up unravels when the paperwork reaches the capital. The Ministry of Justice reviews the case files. They aren't just reading the narrative summary, they're reviewing the official imperial autopsy reports.
The Qing judicial system had highly specific forensic protocols, and the physical evidence completely contradicted the magistrate's narrative of a flying wine bowl.
The autopsy details are visceral and undeniable. The coroner found a massive 1-inch-3/10 fracture on the waiter's skull, deep enough to expose the brain.
But more critically, they found a severe blunt force injury to the victim's kidney and lower back area.
The ministry officials look at this and immediately realize a tossed ceramic bowl does not cause deep tissue trauma to the kidneys and shatter a skull.
They interrogate the witnesses again, and the true sequence of events comes out.
It wasn't an accident. It was a multi-stage lethal assault. The witnesses testify that Xu Pan, enraged by the waiter's refusal, grabbed Zhang San by the arm, violently punched him in the kidney.
And then, as the man was incapacitated, took the heavy ceramic wine bowl and smashed it directly into his skull with enough force to shatter the bone.
The waiter died instantly from the trauma.
The Ministry of Justice recognized the initial report as a blatant fabrication. They completely overruled the corrupt local magistrate.
They stripped away the accidental misstep classification and resentenced Xu Pan under the law of brawling, which covers intentional violent assault resulting in death.
The new sentence handed down by the highest court in the land is absolute. Death by strangulation.
When Jia Zhang reads the words death by strangulation, He doesn't just feel a wave of sympathy for his wife's nephew. He is struck by pure, unadulterated terror.
He physically reacts, slapping his desk and shouting, "It's over!"
His panic is entirely self-centered because he suddenly realizes the perimeter of his plausible deniability has collapsed.
He remembers with sickening clarity that he is deeply implicated in the cover-up.
When Xu Pan was first arrested, the family went into crisis management mode. Jia Zeng's own nephew, Jia Lin, had physically traveled to Taiping County with massive chests of silver to bribe the local magistrate.
Jia Zeng himself had written letters to officials in the area requesting leniency and leveraging his political weight to ensure the initial fake report was filed.
He realizes that if the Ministry of Justice investigates why the local magistrate lied, they're going to uncover a trail of bribery and extortion that leads directly from the dead waiter's body straight back to Jia Zeng's immaculate study.
The corruption he thought he could insulate himself from, the rot he allowed Li Xie to manage in the shadows, has infected his entire family structure.
He is exposed legally and morally to the wrath of the emperor.
And this is where the narrative delivers its most chilling, cynical punchline. Jia Zeng is hyperventilating. He is terrified. He is about to lose his rank, his property, and potentially his own life in a massive political purge.
Amidst this panic, Li Xie casually strolls into the study to remind Jia Zeng that it's time to attend a meeting with his superiors.
Jia Zeng frantically thrusts the gazette at him, explaining the death sentence, the murder, the collapsed cover-up.
Li Xie's reaction is a masterclass in bureaucratic sociopathy. He looks at the document detailing a brutal murder and an impending execution, and he doesn't even blink.
He is completely, utterly unfazed.
Li Xie practically rolls his eyes. He tells Jia Zeng, "Master, if the ministry handled it this way, it's actually a bargain. You are panicking over nothing."
He explains that everyone in the capital's political circles knows perfectly well that Xu Pan beat the man to death.
Li Xie dismantles Jia Zeng's fear by explaining the true motive of the Ministry of Justice. He says, "The ministry isn't pursuing justice for a dead waiter. They overturned the local magistrate's ruling because the local magistrate kept all the bribe money for himself and didn't kick a percentage up to the officials in the Ministry of Justice."
Li Xie assures Jia Zeng that this death sentence is nothing more than high-level bureaucratic leverage. He utters a phrase that defines the entire era: officials protect officials.
The system will not cannibalize itself over a peasant.
The worst that will happen, Li Xie explains, is that the local magistrate will be quietly fired for administrative incompetence, not corruption. And the Jia family will simply have to route a much larger direct bribe to the ministry officials in the capital to quietly commute the death sentence to exile or a fine.
It is genuinely astounding. Li Xie looks at a man paralyzed by the moral horror of his own complicity in a murder cover-up and tells him, "Don't overthink it. Just go to your meeting. Don't be late for the superiors."
He entirely normalizes the grotesque reality of their world. Human life, violent death, imperial justice, the philosophical mandates of heaven, none of it actually matters.
They're all just abstract concepts used to negotiate the price of a bribe. They are line items in an endless ledger of corruption.
And Jia Zeng, utterly broken, realizing his moral philosophy is entirely useless, has no choice but to listen to his servant. He straightens his robes, puts on his official hat, and walks out the door to his meeting.
A completely hollow man pretending the structure around him isn't collapsing.